Blog Talk Radio.
The Eastern world, it is exploding, violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you feel the fears I'm feeling today? If the button is pushed, there's no running away. There'll be no one to save with the world in a grave. Take a look around you, boy. It's bound to scare you, boy. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. So mad, feels like coagulating. I'm sitting here just contemplating. I can't twist the truth, it knows no regulation. Handful of senators don't pass legislation, and marches alone can't bring integration. When human respect is disintegrating, this whole crazy world is just too frustrating. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Think of all the hate there is in Red China, then take a look around to Selma, Alabama. You may leave here for 4 days in space, but when you return, it's the same old place. The pounding of the drums, the pride and disgrace. You can bury your dead, but don't leave a trace. Hate your next door neighbor, but don't forget to take rest. And tell me over and over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. No, no, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
Things that are old are new again. Good evening, everybody. James Bostic here, Conservative's Perspective on Patriot Nation Radio here at Blog Talk Radio. I have something I want to share with you here. As you guys know, I am constantly reading. I am constantly trying to find the most current, most accurate information out there to share with you. And so I am constantly scanning the internet and talking with my friends that are likewise minded and do this kind of stuff. And, you know, we share information. I have a quote here that I read over the weekend that I want to share with you. And it struck me the moment I read it. And I know that it's going to do the same thing to you. We the people must ask a simple question. Why in the world would the President of the United States act as he has in so many ways to endanger America and Americans? Indeed, we should ask all politicians how their actions and policies are in the best interests of America and Americans. For far too long, the citizens of our country have failed to ask the hard questions to hold our politicians accountable. And today, as a consequence of our failures of citizens of our republic, we are now paying one hell of a price. Let that germinate for just a moment. As a consequence of our failures as citizens of our republic, we are now paying one hell of a price. Well, the prescient and remarkably erudite and articulate man who wrote that is with us this evening. He was a Immigration Naturalization Services federal agent for over 30 years. His areas of expertise included counterintelligence, organized crime, immigration fraud, and counterterrorism as these things pertained to his particular purview, which was immigration, legal, illegal, and otherwise. Our friend, my friend, and I'm really happy to have him back with us tonight, Mr. Michael Cutler. Michael, welcome back.
Well, thank you, James. Thank you for that wonderful introduction. The music today, your bumper lead-in music, boy, oh boy, as I was listening, it brought back memories. Of course, that was written during the Vietnam War and performed during the Vietnam War. But, you know, what do they say? Hang on to your old neckties. They'll be back in style soon enough.
Yeah.
And here we are. But, you know, what really disturbs me, I was in and out of watching the hearing. I mean, it was about all these members of the Senate bloviating, for lack of a better term, asking the same questions over and over from a slightly different angle. It could have been summed up in a 30-minute hearing. And you know, I've been before something like 17 hearings in the House and Senate. I was called by Sheila Jackson Lee, mostly by the Republicans, but I worked with the Democrats. One of the things I enjoyed doing was schlepping, as we say in Brooklyn, dragging the counsels from both sides of the aisle together with me to have lunch when I was in Washington to sit down and hammer out understandings. I helped to work to come up with legislation. Didn't get paid for it. I did it as a citizen. Think about that. We have got to take citizenship seriously. And when if you remember Barbara Boxer, she really ignited a fire under my tail when she went at it with a member of the military who called her ma'am rather than senator.
Right.
And in full pretentiousness, she went after that poor officer. How dare you call me ma'am? I am a senator. I worked hard to become a senator. Can you or anybody tell me what the qualifications are to be a United States senator or to be a president? To be a federal agent, I had to go through a security clearance that took a long time. We had formal training. We had a year of an internship where we could have been fired on any given day. As a new agent, I worked with rotating senior agents who did evaluations similar to the Marine Corps. They did what were known as CNEs, conduct and efficiency reports, that delved into everything that I did or didn't do. Was I on time? Were my shoes shined? I kid you not. If I chased someone, did I run until I caught him, or did I give up after two blocks? How good was my skill as an investigator, as an interrogator? How clearly were my reports written? This was in detail. And there were people who washed out. If you couldn't master Spanish language, which was a requirement, you washed out. What's the vetting process for our political elites? Think about it. Think what a doctor goes through to become a doctor, and God knows they screw up often enough. For all the talk about the need to defund the police because some wackaloon cops who never should have been cops act inappropriately. And any death, by the way, is a tragedy. I'm not trying to minimize a single death. I remember listening to the great Alan Dershowitz, and I'm a huge fan of Alan Dershowitz. Those of you who are familiar with me know my background. Those of you not familiar with me, let me clue you in. I'm Jewish. I was a B'nai B'rith president back in college. I'm a first-generation American. My mother came to America at the age of 13, oozing white privilege. She lived by herself in a rooming house and supported herself at the tender age of 13 by working in a sweatshop making umbrellas for $3 a week. How's that for white privilege? When I hear these terms, my head explodes. My dad's family came from Russia. He was a construction worker with an eighth grade education. I carried him off his job his last day at work because at age 57, he was dying of lung cancer, in part because he smoked those god-awful Chesterfield cigarettes, but more significantly because he worked in the Navy shipyards during the Second World War to contribute to the war effort. And so that was my background. And I grew up understanding what hard work was all about. And I look at what it takes to become a doctor. And doctors, if you look at the statistics, medical malpractice kills 250,000 people a year, according to Johns Hopkins. No one ever talks about defunding hospitals. But some crazy cops who never should have been police officers or who in the heat of the moment fire when perhaps they shouldn't. Suddenly we have riots across America, an attempt to take down the White House that the Democrats won't refer to as an insurrection, but what happened on January 6th they describe as an insurrection, which cost the life of an unarmed woman who was shot by a Capitol Police officer. And if you listen to the interview, if you listen to what Jonathan Turley had to say, a liberal lawyer, he said that basically the cop had no justification. He couldn't see the woman's hands, didn't know what was in the backpack, didn't know what was in the mind. He was scared because she was coming through the window and he fired. Now we come back to Dershowitz, and I mentioned Alan because of my heritage. My first wife happened to have been Jewish also, as is my current wife. My first wife died of cancer many years ago. Her parents were in the Holocaust. So every year they were invited to attend a memorial service for the Holocaust. And they asked me if I would take my two boys, one of them her grandson, my grandmother, my in-law's grandson, to this amazing memorial service at Temple Emmanuel, which, by the way, is where I buried my current wife. Beautiful temple down the road from St. Patrick's Cathedral. The beautiful thing about New York is we have every religion, every ethnicity represented in great abundance, which is one of the things I love about New York. So much for the notion that if you want immigration laws enforced, you're a xenophobe or a racist. But Dershowitz made the point that one death, according to Stalin, is a tragedy, but a million deaths is a statistic. And that's why Dershowitz said, when you look at any mass murder, whether it's the Holocaust, whether it's a terror attack, always multiply the number of victims by the number one, because each and every life that is taken is a separate and discrete murder that victimizes families, friends, associates, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Forget the big number. Look at each victim of that event as a single murder. And when I spoke to a mother who lost her son on 9/11, he was a new firefighter. When they sent her the death certificate, she told me that what hit her in the heart was where it said cause of death, murder. Murder. Her son was murdered. Terror attack, but he was murdered. But yet, you look at what it takes to become the professionals, engineers and scientists and airline pilots and surgeons and federal agents and police officers and military officers. So tell me, James, what's the requirement to become an elected representative? Bupkis. Not a damn thing.
Money and connections.
And this, right. Connections and the ability to be a good enough con artist that you could swindle people to contribute to your campaign and vote for you in the election booth. And so here's Barbara Boxer, all inflated, full of hot air. If you want to worry about climate change, think of all the hot air being spewed by the politicians. Maybe they could shut their traps and they could save us some global warming. What do you think? All of them. I've had it with all of them, by the way. I've testified before all these hearings. I wish these idiots had listenings. I wish they had listenings. Both parties. I'm an equal opportunity offender. I dislike all of them, all the above. Now, there are a couple of good politicians. But finding a good politician is almost as difficult as finding a virgin in a house of prostitution. What do you think of that analogy? Because it is
the two career paths are very similar, aren't they?
Yes, they are. In fact, I wasn't going to start out with this, but now that we've gone...
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Now that... Forgive my rage, but I lived through 9/11, and I'm sitting here listening to what's happening in Afghanistan and what's happening on the border.
Oh my God.
And I'm trying to figure out, James, why in the world I wasted my time going down to do all those hearings. And I drove down many times, not even to testify, but to work with members of Congress, their staffs and so forth, to try to protect us. Because they seemed to care. I mean, some of those folks did back then. And, of course, their campaigns were defunded. People like John Hostetler, the Republican chairman of the House Immigration Subcommittee, because he was outraged by what Bush did. And then they defunded his campaign. And Bush now says that anybody who wants America to take its citizens' concerns first is a nativist. By the way, I plead guilty. I'm a nativist. If you look up nativist, it means somebody who puts the needs of the citizens ahead of the immigrants. Sign me up. And that's not a statement of racism. When you look at America's population, we have the most diverse population of any country on planet Earth. I don't care if you're green, white, or have yellow polka dots. If you're an American citizen, the American government should be working night and day tirelessly for your best interest and the best interest of you and your children. And it's not. I promise you it's doing the exact opposite. So I talked about the similarities between the two oldest professions. Well, I was giving a speech in Washington a number of years ago, and I don't normally have a script, but I decided, because I heard that there were going to be some politicians in the audience, that I wanted to get it right. So I committed this to paper, and I brought this up on stage with me. Similarity between prostitution and politics. Both professions begin with the letter P. Both professions involve lots of people getting screwed. In both professions, the practitioners will assume any position, no matter how ridiculous, uncomfortable, contrary to common sense, or even dangerous, for the right price. In prostitution, the clientele bring their fantasies that the prostitute tries to fulfill. In politics, the constituents bring their concerns, and the politicians respond by making promises that they fulfill by creating fantasies. STDs can give the clients of prostitutes a case of buyer's remorse, or perhaps something more serious, while voters may as well suffer buyer's remorse when they come to find out what their elected official actually does once he or she is sworn into office. Talk about the gift that keeps on giving. How's that for an analogy?
Yeah, I never get tired of that one. I never do.
Well, and it's accurate.
Yeah, the career paths are very similar. I mean, you get people with pedigrees in politics. George Bush is an excellent example. The dynastic candidates. You know what I mean? And they grew up in the body politic, or they've been close, or they've had influence with it. You're right. There's really nothing special about them. They may have a deeper pocket. Their nepotism may be a little bit stronger than our own, but beyond that, no, there's nothing really that remarkable about them, and we see it every time these clowns open their mouths.
But you hear this pretentiousness. How dare you call me ma'am?
Oh, yeah.
You know, I would have probably turned around and said, hey, Babs, what's the issue here?
Simmer down, honey. Everything's okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, I met Congressman Louie Gohmert, and I like Louie. As I said, there are a few good people in Washington. You have to look far and wide. And when I met him, I said, Congressman, you're going to have to forgive me, but I have this nasty habit. But when I meet elected representatives, I insist on referring to them by their first name simply because I like to establish the employer-employee relationship quickly and decisively. Well,
I'm sure he got a kick out of
it. He did. And he said, you know, Mr. Cutler, he said, I used to be a judge, and when I was a judge, I insisted on being referred to as judge because I was sitting in judgment of the people in my community in Texas. That's right. But he said,
yeah.
As a member of Congress, I have to simply represent the people who are my neighbors. How can I represent them if I put myself on a pedestal? He said, my name is Louie. My mom and dad gave me that name. I love them tremendously. They love me. So why in the world would I not want you to call me Louie? He said, I hope I'm clear, Mr. Cutler. I said, yes, but there's one more matter that we have to tend to. He said, what's that? I said, well, if I'm going to call you Louie, then you should be calling me Mike and not Mr. Cutler. So we shook hands on that one. But we need to be doing this as a matter of routine. Knock these bums off those high horses they rode into town on. They put on their pants one leg at a time if they decide to wear pants, no matter what their gender is. We've got to get this wall that they've erected of I'm so important, like the wall they put up around D.C. while leaving our border wide open. And I listened today, and I was furious because I already knew where this was all going to go. Folks, border security is national security. The Immigration Service, when I hired on, refused to take itself seriously because the government refused to take it seriously. How in the world do you not take the security of your borders seriously in a dangerous world? If the police knocked on your door and said, be careful, there's a bunch of burglars and home invaders out there, especially at night, do you think you might double lock your door before you went to sleep at night? Do you think you might close your windows? Do you think you might take other measures to protect yourself against the potential that some thug might try to break into your house? Of course you would. So then why then does America somehow not get the connection between border security and national security? Now, I mentioned that I testified before the House Immigration Subcommittee many times. I gave testimony to the 9/11 Commission. I testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee. I've been all over the place in D.C. So when I watch hearings, I watch it with a slightly different perspective, having, if you want to call it that, played that game myself. But the 9/11 staff, the commission staff that worked with the members of the 9/11 Commission, which consisted of government lawyers and federal agents from various agencies, including the FBI and INS back then and other such agencies, put together a specific report that went beyond what the 9/11 Commission wrote in the 9/11 Commission report. And this was the 9/11 Commission staff report on terrorist travel. And the reason they insisted on writing this extra report, they wrote a couple of extra reports like that, was because they looked at immigration, and immigration was determined to be the number one failure that not only permitted the terror attacks of 9/11 to take place, but the 9/11 Commission looked back 10 years and found consistently failures of the immigration system that led to terror attacks or the potential for terror attacks where people were either arrested before they could carry them out, failed because of dumb luck or stupidity or whatever. And in some cases, there were attacks that did succeed, like the 93 bombing at the Trade Center and the shooting at the CIA. All involved aliens who violated our immigration laws in multiple ways. So how do you ignore the significance? I'm blessed because I work with the Speakers Bureau in Washington. I've mentioned it before. And so I've had the privilege and the pleasure of addressing military leaders on numerous occasions down in Washington or occasionally at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. So I've been in the front of the room with a bunch of generals and colonels and senior civilian employees of the Air Force and other military agencies, the intelligence services and so forth. And 2 years ago, or about 2.5 years ago, I was really surprised because one of the people in attendance to the seminar had just come back from the space station. He was one of America's astronauts. And to me, those guys are heroes. When I was a kid, I got letters from Alan Shepard and Gus Grissom. I wouldn't trade those letters for any sports memorabilia in the world. And when I had prostate cancer, to cheer me up, because I thought this was it, having lost both of my parents and my first wife to cancer, I thought I was on final glide path. Thankfully, I wasn't, because I haven't aggravated my quota yet. But to cheer me up, my wife made two purchases and surprised me with them. One was a model of the X-1, the plane that broke the sound barrier. By the way, I think it's Nat Geo or the History Channel, one or the other, in 2 weeks will be doing a special series of programs about breaking the sound barrier. So she got me a model of the X1 that was autographed by Chuck Yeager, believe it or not, and a poster signed by Buzz Aldrin. And so that poster hangs in my living room, and that model of the X1 sits on the bookcase in my office, and I love looking at it every now and again. I did old single-engine flying as a kid, not to make any comparison with what Yeager or the astronauts did, but I was going to be an aerospace engineer had I not lost my parents to cancer when I was in college. And by the way, that's why I believe instead of critical race theory, we should be teaching critical empathy theory, because I don't care about the superficial issues, you know, race, religion, ethnicity, gender, superficial. Life is a tough proposition for everybody, and we should be cheering everyone on. This should be a team sport, not a sport of hostility and division that the politicians have turned it into so that they could somehow gather up votes and get political campaign contributions, which is really Orwellian newspeak for bribe, but they really are, they're bribes. But when I've spoken in front of these military leaders, I've made a point, and they've come up to me and said, wow, you know, Mr. Cutler, we never thought of it that way, but you're right. Because what I had said to them is that what the five branches of the military are charged with, pardon me, is to keep the enemies of America as far from our shores as possible. But guess who gets that vital assignment up close and in person? It's the Border Patrol and ICE agents. Because in order to attack us, they had to come here. So now let's look at the first paragraph. This is in the preface of that 9/11 Commission staff report on terrorist travel. And what's shocking about it, as you will see, is that people didn't make that connection initially. It's stupefying. Who's running the show? Did we hire idiots? Are there village idiots being employed in our government and the villages are missing their idiots profoundly now? Here's the paragraph that begins that report. It is perhaps obvious to state that terrorists cannot plan and carry out attacks in the United States if they are unable to enter the country. Yet prior to September 11, while there were efforts to enhance border security, no agency of the U.S. government thought of border security as a tool in the counterterrorism arsenal. Indeed, even after 19 hijackers demonstrated the relative ease of obtaining a U.S. visa and gaining admission into the United States, border security still is not considered a cornerstone of national security policy. We believe, for reasons we discuss in the following pages, that it must be made one. Just stop and think of the enormity of that admission. The idiots running our country couldn't figure out that you have to keep the bad guys out of the country if you're going to protect your country and your citizens. Is this not insane? Is this not an admission of galactic stupidity? And where are we now? We're being told that America, and I agree with this. Someone asked me the other day, I was on a program, and they said, well, compared to where we were on 9/11, where are we now? I said, oh, back then, I said, I'm actually nostalgic for September 10th. Because on 9/11, 19 hijackers armed with box cutters took down four airplanes, turned them into de facto cruise missiles, and changed the world. Did a huge number on America, thousands. Forget the 3,000 that died on 9/11. We've lost at least 2,000 or maybe 3,000 more since then, because roughly every week, 2 more people die because of the toxins they ingested when the towers came down, and most of them are first responders like police officers who we're defunding. Stop and think about this, folks. I mean, if I sound like I'm enraged, I am. I knew a number of those cops who died, because it was the emergency service crews that responded to the towers, and I used to work with them on high-risk entries. When they were not available, or when SWAT or special response teams from immigration or the FBI or ATF or whatever, or DEA weren't available, then we would go in. I'd grab a body bunker, a shotgun, and we would go in. But if we had the luxury of a SWAT team or the equivalent, they would go in. And the NYPD equivalent of SWAT, Special Weapons and Tactics, is called Emergency Services. And they helped me, in fact, shortly before I retired or left the job. I was injured in the line of duty, injured my leg executing warrants with the FBI and the New York City Police Department. We arrested a Cuban who had came to the United States during the boat lift. He was a one-man crime wave working out of Chicago, and he killed an American black kid, a 20-something-year-old who got involved with the drug trade. He had him killed. We found him here in New York on the run from the police. I actually got a warrant charging him as an illegal alien with the possession of a firearm, which gave the NYPD emergency service team justification to take down the door in what's known as a dynamic entry, where they kick the door down and throw in the flashbang. And they got him. It was emergency services who worked with me, with DEA and with the FBI, to take this piece of trash into custody. I testified in Chicago. He was sentenced to life without parole. But he was taken into custody without incident by emergency services. A number of those police officers charged into the towers and never came out. But we're going to defund the police. I don't think it's a stretch to understand my rage, my absolute rage. And now Biden is going after the Border Patrol because they were on horseback trying to prevent the entry of illegal aliens. How dare they be aggressive? And he hires this clown Mayorkas, who when he was in charge of Citizenship and Immigration Services, the agency that adjudicates applications for various immigration benefits, for example, the granting of political asylum or visas or green cards or citizenship, he ordered his people to get to yes. Approve, 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 even though the 9/11 Commission warned about how immigration fraud was the key vulnerability that was exploited multiple times by terrorists to enter the country and hide in plain sight, or in the words of the commission, embed themselves. The people at Immigration were so outraged by Mayorkas that they went to Internal Affairs, the Office of Inspector General. That's pretty gutsy because it could cost you big time. He was suspending people. In fact, one woman who ran a major operation for him, he ordered her to approve applications, and she said, legally, we can't approve them. He said, if you don't approve them, I'll find someone else and I will demote you. He did. And he had her working out of her living room because she refused to improperly approve a visa that, by the way, had been used according to an investigation by terrorists in the past, the EB-5 Treaty Investor Visa. The Office of Inspector General found significant wrongdoing by Mayorkas. It's public record. And when the Republicans raised that issue, when Mayorkas was presented as the Biden guy for Homeland Security, the Democrats said, oh, we don't care. And he is now running Homeland Security. He's going to be doing the vetting of the Afghan refugees, Alejandro Mayorkas. And when they talked about his qualifications, it's about the fact that he's a Latino and he's an immigrant, et cetera, et cetera. What about his qualifications to do the job effectively and preserve America's national security? That's not an issue. We needed somebody who was a Latino, I guess. And that box got checked. They said, that's all. He's good to go. Imagine if you hired a doctor that way. Imagine, God forbid, you have appendicitis. And they say, well, we have a wonderful female Latina. Is she good? Oh, she kills people all the time. But she's a woman doctor.
How long you want to live anyway?
I mean, right? You want to prolong things? Come on, she can get this business over with quickly. What are we doing? I had someone say to me when Hillary was running for president, wouldn't it be nice to have a woman president? I said, wouldn't it be nice to have a competent, moral leader as president? The Wicked Witch of the West, I called her the Hillary virus. She's a virus in two senses of the word. A virus in a computer corrupts the system, and the other kind of virus makes you sick. Well, she certainly was trying to make America sick. So we get Joe Biden, who actually could make her look like not so bad, maybe. How do you defend America when we've admitted hundreds of thousands of illegal aliens who have not been screened, they're sick, they didn't get vaccinated, and we don't know if they're terrorists? And then we hear, well, we have people on the terror watch list. I'm going to let you know a secret. Most terrorists aren't on the watch list. Some of them are, and when they are, you know, that's good. We stop them, and that's great. But a lot of the terrorists, like the 9/11 hijackers, many of them were unknown to us. They purposely pick young men, sometimes women, but mostly men. Why? Well, ideologically, they haven't had the opportunity to think things through. You know, I have a theory, James, that as an experiment, you could just read the transcript of people standing on a street corner having a conversation, but you couldn't see them or hear their voices. So the only way that you might be able to figure out their relative age is by the words they use. Obviously, if you look at them, you go, oh, he's 12 years old. Okay, fine. No, just look at the words. And I remember this, and maybe you folks remember this. There's nobody who has more certainty than a young person. I remember, you know, 15, 18 years old, you'd be having an argument with your friend, and you would always say things like, can't be, has to be, must be, always, never, the absolutes.
Yes.
The older you get, the more you temper it with, well, I don't think that's likely. I don't think that that's probable, because life teaches you that there are very few certainties in life. But when you're young, you have all the answers. Mark Twain summed it up pretty well. Mark Twain said that when he was 15, he was convinced his father was a complete idiot, and he was shocked at how much his father learned by the time he turned 21.
Yeah.
How am I doing? Am I right?
He's doing on all eight cylinders, man. All eight cylinders.
And the question that begs is, and it's like
the quote I read from you.
Yep.
What policy have these people enacted? What policy have they put in place that has benefited the country? Not just with the border, but anywhere, domestic or foreign policy. What have they done, and how is it good for the country? And there's nothing there.
But that's
nothing.
Because they've been bought and paid for, because they know what the campaign contributors expect, and the system is so corrupt in ways that you folks have no idea. And I want to tell you a little bit about how corrupt and how screwed up the entire system is. Because one of the things no one really pays attention to are the staffers. Now, these are not elected officials. Congressional staffers, usually in their 20s, they have all the certainty of that kid standing on the street corner using the absolute terms with great abandon. Always, never, has to be, can't be, right? And they went to the Ivy League schools and they drank the Kool-Aid, not with one straw, but two straws, every day. Every day. They drank the Kool-Aid. And now they go work for Congressman Schmidlap, for lack of a term. Put in the blank, whoever it is. And you go to meet with that kid. And that kid, very often, is more arrogant than anybody you've ever met. I mean, think about it. They've graduated magna cum nonsense from God knows what university. They've been raised to believe that they are self-important and brilliant and flawless, just like the terrorists, right? And what you don't know is the lobbying outfits on K Street are always looking to recruit among the staffers. Hey, Charlie, how do you like working for Congressman so-and-so? Yeah, he's pretty good. What are they paying you? Oh, I'm making about 80 a year. 80? Hell, we can get you 200 next year, but we could use a couple of good votes from your representative. Think about what happens now. So I go to have a meeting with Joe Smith, the congressman's staffer. Oh, Mr. Cutler, how are you? Oh, I'm great. Come sit down with me in my office. And he sits there, and he's so impressed with himself. And you have this conversation, and you take a position that goes against those people that want this kid to go work for them next year. And you do a presentation, and you hand them a folder with all kinds of documents, and you say, here it is, and you spend an hour with this guy. And he says, wow, that's phenomenal. Thank you, Mr. Cutler. What's to prevent him from taking that packet of paper, shredding it, and the congressman comes in and says, hey, Charlie, that guy Cutler came in. What do you think? Oh, nonsense, boss. Nothing to see there. That's what I thought. Thanks so much for handling it for me. Now, was it that I didn't have much to say? Or is it that he's eyeing that job for $200,000 next year? Think how corrupt this is. So now, keep that in mind, and I'll tell you two stories, boys and girls, as we pull it together and get our chocolate milk out. We'll sit around in a circle, and we'll tell campfire stories. So after 9/11, I went to the Senate, and there was this kid who worked for Senator Lieberman, who I thought was a decent guy, and most of these senators are naive children, And by the way, I had a big fight with Bob Goodlatte. He was the Republican chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. He's an immigration lawyer. And the first thing he said when we had this meeting, and it was arranged by one of his key contributors, because that's how you get access, and I had testified before Goodlatte a number of times, and he said, "Mr. Cutler, before you get started, you need to know something." I said, "What's that?" "I know much, 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 much more about immigration than you know or ever will know, because I am an immigration lawyer." I said, "Yes, and that explains some of your wacky decisions, I suspect." And he was glowering at me when I said it. And as you might expect, this is a guy that made a fortune by processing H-1B visa applications. So when he came to Congress, what was his goal? To increase the number of H-1B visas so he and his buddies would have more clients and more billable hours. And when I had this argument with him about why are you so in favor of bringing in high-tech workers when we have Americans who are brilliant, qualified, and experienced, he wouldn't answer me. And I quoted Alan Greenspan, who back on April 30th, 2009, testified for Chuck Schumer and said that the solution to wage inequality is to do exactly what Bill Gates wants. Of course, Bill Gates, the ultimate campaign contributor, right? And he said, "We need to have an unlimited number of H-1B visas because we don't have enough high-tech people in America." Not true. And if that was the case, why aren't we trying to educate American kids to take those jobs the way we used to? And so the solution is to go to the third world and bring in a bunch of third world people, because if we could get that wage premium we're paying to these high-tech workers reduced, then we greatly reduce wage inequality between Americans with skills and those with lesser skills. In other words, if we get rid of the middle class, the working poor will have nobody to be envious of. And my first wife, who I had mentioned previously, was a brilliant computer programmer. She was a Phi Beta Kappa graduate, had an MBA in computer science. She was a member of the National Math Honor Society. And when she turned 30 or 31, they put her in charge of a division of the company that did the backroom paperwork for the New York and American Stock Exchanges. She had a team of 33 or 34 programmers and engineers reporting to her at that young age. And most of the people who worked for her were Americans with similar academic credentials. In fact, Dan Rather did a documentary called No Thanks for Everything, where he interviewed four programmers who got fired for no reason other than the fact they wanted to replace them with cheaper foreign programmers. And no matter how I tried to get Goodlatte to talk about the issue, he wouldn't. And finally, he said, "Listen, I'm sorry about your first wife passing away, but my son knows a lot about computers, and he would love to bring in tens of thousands of brilliant programmers from India." In fact, there was a woman on his staff who was of Indian ethnicity, and he almost always tried to pose with her whenever there was a picture taken of him at the hearings. Think about that. And I said, "Wait a minute. You're the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. You oversee the FBI. You oversee the courts. You oversee the U.S. Marshals Service. You oversee DEA. You oversee the FBI, and you oversee immigration. And your concern is to bring in people from India, not to make certain that Americans have the opportunities they should have if they're willing to study hard and work hard? Can you explain it? Are the American programmers chopped liver to you? Why aren't you representing Americans instead of Indians?" And at that point, of course, the meeting was over. So his son, who is, if you look him up, by the way, whatever I tell you, you can take it to the bank, literally. Look up Bobby Goodlatte, G-O-O-D-L-A-T-T-E, Bobby Goodlatte, Bob Goodlatte's son, is, I believe, in his 30s, and he's quite wealthy. Why? From hiring foreign programmers. So when you hear this nonsense about social justice, well, we need to take these people that are being arrested and turn them free because the system is corrupt. Why are people getting involved with crime? Why don't we look at the environment people who are getting arrested grow up in, right? You look at the little seedling, how the seedling grows determines its health as it gets older. When you have children living in violent environments where heat in the wintertime is a luxury, when they walk into an apartment where there are rats running around the hallways and bugs covering the walls, I didn't read about this somewhere, folks. I was there. I was out on the street. I got my hands dirty every day. I was in the best neighborhoods and I was in the worst neighborhoods. I took lots of bad guys off the street. I used to call my job that of human garbage collector. Murderers, drug dealers, rapists. And so you have children growing up in that neighborhood. I remember one day I worked closely with the Israeli National Police. My first fraud investigation caused me to trip over a terror plot in Israel. Thankfully, we prevented the bombing of an oil refinery. So as you might imagine, from that day on, I had a wonderful working relationship with the Israelis. And they're being shafted royally by this administration, as they were by the Obama administration, as they were by the Carter administration. Isn't it remarkable? Think about the parallels. Jimmy Carter brought Khomeini back to Iran.
Yeah.
And they showed their gratitude by taking our embassy hostage and 51 Americans hostage. And now Biden is Carter on steroids. And we have God knows how many hundreds or maybe thousands of Americans trapped inside of Afghanistan. The parallels are striking. I don't know what's going on here. But I remember one day I was giving a tour to the Israeli police general assigned to the consulate in New York. In fact, on 9/11, he called me up. He was back in Israel. His assignment had finished. He was here for a three-year rotation. He called to make certain that my family and I survived 9/11. And he was in tears on the phone, as I was. That night, I'll never forget the phone call I got from Israel. But he asked me if I would drive him and one of his colleagues, another police general, and we were driving through a particularly nasty neighborhood, and we heard gunfire. And he turned to me and said, how are you going to explain it if one of us gets killed? I said, I'll hand in my resignation if I'm not the one who gets shot. Now, we kind of joked about it. It was a kind of gallows humor. But think of the kids growing up in this neighborhood where bullets routinely whiz by their window. And I asked this of Goodlatte. I said, if you're a child growing up in that kind of poverty, the question isn't what are you willing to do to get out of it, what won't you do? And for the most part, the only way out of poverty and out of that neighborhood with the bullets flying and the rodents infesting your building is to get involved in criminal activity, because the role models there aren't doctors, lawyers, judges, and engineers, but drug dealers and other assorted criminals. We have to break that cycle by providing opportunities for American children. If you really want social justice, it has to start when the child is 20 hours old, not 20 years old, because when you're 20 years old, it's a little bit late. The boat has sailed. So all this BS about social justice should begin by equipping American kids living in poverty with the education they need so they can break the cycle of poverty that they're suffering from right now. But that's not going to happen, because the wealthy want the underclass they can push around and exploit, just like they want the foreign workers that they can exploit. And it's amazing, because the liberal magazine, The Atlantic, talked about all these people who inherit companies, and they're clueless about how to run the company, but they inherit it, so they have great wealth, and they have a big voice in government. Well, they're right. But then they themselves don't see what these people are doing is to keep the working poor, poor, and poorer. I happen to agree with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez on one issue. You know, a broken clock is right every 12 hours, so she had her 12 hours. She is against having Amazon not pay taxes in New York. And I was disappointed that Trump's family was all in. Oh, yes, they shouldn't be paying taxes. They're going to bring jobs. Well, if the standard is that a company that creates jobs doesn't pay taxes, then that should apply to any business that creates jobs. If you have a little delicatessen and you have 10 employees, then you shouldn't pay taxes. If you have a car dealership and you employ 48 people, then you shouldn't pay taxes because you are creating jobs. But to say, well, Amazon creates so many jobs that they shouldn't have to pay taxes, think what that does. So Amazon, which already has all sorts of unreasonable and unfair advantages against the competition because they do everything in bulk, right? If you go out and you buy, you know, a bag of grass seed, you know, you're going to pay whatever. If you go out there and buy 10,000 bags of grass seed, I promise you, you're going to get a quantity discount. Well, that's Amazon. So it makes it that much more difficult for the little guy to compete with Amazon to begin with. Now imagine if Amazon doesn't have to pay taxes on top of it. So that will incite ensconce Amazon permanently at the top of the pyramid and no more competition. And that really is contrary to what capitalism is supposed to be. It's supposed to be survival of the economic fittest. Build a better mousetrap. So why in the world would we say to Amazon, well, you're the big giant, we're not going to have you pay taxes? See, if I was the mayor, I would say, look, if you need to have different parking regulations because you have all those vehicles, I'll work with you. We'll close off the streets around your garage, whatever. We'll change the direction of traffic. We'll put up traffic lights or we'll take down traffic. We'll work with you. But in return, you're going to pay taxes, so the city benefits, and all New Yorkers benefit because you're paying your fair share of taxes. So Ocasio-Cortez is right. This is corporate welfare. Terrible. But the same AOC, as they call her, I call her Alexandria the barmaid. So Alexandria the barmaid ignores the biggest form of corporate welfare that there is, the importation of an army of exploitable foreign workers at the low levels with the illegals and the high-tech visas at the upper level. She would never dream to stop that. She wants to legalize everybody, which will mean more competition for American workers, which will mean fewer people getting jobs and more homelessness. And they keep talking about a $15 an hour minimum wage. Well, I happen to agree with the minimum wage. I have conservative friends who don't agree. And again, as Americans, we should disagree. It's in the First Amendment, the right to peaceable assemblage, the right to speak your mind. We forgot how to debate. I was going to teach debate on the college level when I had the opportunity to become a federal agent. So I decided to go in that direction rather than teach debate. So let's have the debates, peaceful, logical, fact-based, not name-calling, not hate-mongering, because we never have all the answers. We need a free exchange of ideas because someone's always going to come up with a better idea, just the way it is. Whether it's an invention or a philosophy, there's always some guy or some gal that's going to come along with a new idea that's better than what preceded them, and we're going to build on it, just like Einstein came up with his theories of relativity, and then Hawking came along and other scientists. We're always building on the ideas of people that are new to the scene, who have a fresh way of seeing things. So we should have open conversations to be the best that we can be. But I personally believe in a $15 an hour minimum wage. That's fine. But here's the irony. $15 an hour works out to roughly $30,000 a year. And then we have that picture of AOC in that white dress that said, tax the rich, at an event that cost more than a $15 an hour employee grosses in an entire year. How's that for a disconnect if you want to connect dots? She blows a year's worth of pay on a four-hour event because she could. And apparently someone paid for it, and if that doesn't smell like a bribe, I don't know what does. I couldn't get a cup of coffee on duty when I was an agent, and the Israeli National Police used to take me to lunch all the time. So I would take them to dinner because I wasn't allowed to get something for nothing, and I still made sure to mention it to my bosses. And when I had to get my security clearance redone every 4 or 5 years, and they asked, do you work with foreign governments? I certainly talked about my relationship with the Israelis. I got an award from the government of Japan. By the way, the government of Japan gave me a police medal. The only reason I was allowed to keep it was my bosses made the determination that the materials the medal was made out of, those metal wasn't worth more than $30, or it would have been hung on the wall at headquarters. Wouldn't it be nice if our politicians had to live by that standard? Think about that. So you look at all the hypocrisy, and you look at the way the politicians don't give a damn about the fate of American children. When I was a kid, American companies looked at kids in high school as their future employees. That's why we had the College Bowl, the GE College Bowl, the Westinghouse Science Award. Why? Because these American students who excelled would hopefully work for them once they got their degrees. They don't want to hire Americans, folks. Americans expect a living wage. Are you crazy? They'd rather hire somebody from a third world country who will work for one-third what an American would expect and with no fringe benefits. So all they want Americans to do is to spend their money on the garbage that they now produce. And believe me, most of what they produce is garbage. I will tell you, I have a car made by a foreign car company but built in America. And as far as I'm concerned, I'm driving an American car because GM builds their cars out of the country even after we bailed them out. Don't tell me it's an American company. I want to know who bolted it together, who welded that thing. And if you want to get a car made in America, it seems like the best chance you have is to get a car made by like Honda or Acura or Toyota or some other foreign company.
Yeah.
How nuts is that, James? Am I crazy?
No. No, you're not. Some of the best American products by American in the automotive industry is just exactly like what you said. Once upon a time, it was Dodge, it was Chevy, it was Packard, it was Buick, it was Ford. And now you're
Cadillac,
right, it's Hyundai.
Said, that's the Cadillac of whatever. It was the best of the best. Caddy and Lincoln and
exactly.
Chrysler Imperials. Those were the three biggies back then.
Yeah, and now it's Hyundai, it's Kia. It's Honda, like you said. They're foreign companies, but it's made by American workers, and it's
and I
insane.
Want to know American hands put my car together because I love Americans. And that, I guess, again, comes back to me being a nativist. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, I plead guilty. Put it down in writing. I will sign it. Michael W. Cutler is a nativist. How is that an insult? That I want to see the American government put the priorities of American citizens first. If, God forbid, you're at home and you have young children and you get a phone call, there's a fire in the school and you run to the school, who do you want to rescue first, your neighbor's child or your child? Why are we afraid to stand up and look at a George Bush, look him in the eye and say, you imbecile, you Alfred E. Newman lookalike? Are you kidding me?
What, me worry?
What, me worry, exactly.
Do
you
remember
that?
You
know that he put together DHS in violation of law? So I was there for the hearing. I've written about it. Go to my articles at Front Page or go to my articles at U.S. Incorporated, usinc.org. And John Hostetler, I want to read this. I think I've read it in the past, but it's worth reviewing it again because when I saw what Bush said, and I was told every time he testified before I testified before Congress, he would go nuts. He used to go crazy. He hated my guts, but I returned the favor. I mean, this guy is a disaster. And, you know, mission accomplished. Remember that circus stunt?
Oh, yeah.
Mission accomplished. Mission, I mean, could you believe that? By the way, here was the direct quote from Alan Greenspan. And Goodlatte wouldn't address it until I made three or four attempts. This is what Greenspan said about foreign workers. And he also talked about the need to bring in lots of illegal aliens, the unauthorized, because they're a flexible labor force that only minimally suppresses wages. If you suppress wages minimally for someone at poverty level, they become homeless, folks. So here were the two big deals that he said about the high-tech workers. First, skilled workers, and when they say skilled, I mean people with graduate degrees, so we understand what we're talking about. First, skilled workers and their families form new households. They will, of necessity, move into vacant housing units, the current glut of which is depressing prices of American homes. This is back in 2009, right? Why did we have the crisis? Because of that or because of the subprime mortgages that he was pushing on America? And we know what the answer is. It was his subprime mortgages. So he calls it the vacant housing unit. Doesn't it sound like a Norman Rockwell painting? Can't you just see that imagery? Vacant housing unit, right. And, of course, house price declines, his words, house price declines are a major factor in mortgage foreclosures and the plunge in value of the vast quantity of U.S. mortgage-backed securities that's contributed substantially to the disabling of our banking system. Baloney. It was the subprime mortgages, giving people mortgages they could not afford. And when they defaulted, you wound up with, quote, vacant housing units. What a liar. And this is the guy who has mansions all over the place, including out in the Hamptons. But the second paragraph is the one that if you need blood pressure pills, I will wait about 10 seconds so you can grab your blood pressure meds and swallow them down so you avoid the rush later, okay? The second bonus to flooding America with high-tech workers, he didn't say flooding America, that's me. But the second bonus would address the increasing concentration of income in this country. In other words, someone's making too much money, but he's not talking about himself or Bill Gates or Zuckerberg or any of those nitwits, right? So the second bonus would address the increasing concentration of income in this country, greatly expanding our quotas for the highly skilled would lower wage premiums of the skilled over the lesser skilled. Skill shortages in America exist because we're shielding our skilled labor force from world competition. Quotas have been substituted for the wage pricing mechanism, and in the process, we have created a privileged elite. James, when have you ever heard somebody talk about American middle-class high-tech workers and call them the privileged elite? If this isn't offensive and outrageous, I don't know what is.
I've never heard
it. Created, well, he did, and the media never covered it. So we have created a privileged elite whose incomes are being supported at non-competitively high levels by immigration quotas on skilled professionals. Eliminating such restrictions would reduce at least some of our income inequality. I guess they've got to do more to damage America's middle class. And Bob Goodlatte, conservative Republican, allegedly, would not answer my question. See, you got to ask them the question. You got to pin them down like a frog to the paraffin when we used to do those dissections back in high school biology. Pin that bum down to the paraffin. Now, let's go back to what Hostetler had to say about the way they put, let me see if I can find this. Bear with me one moment. I apologize.
Go right ahead. We're talking with Michael Cutler, our friend from a couple years back at Rock the Red, Greenville, South Carolina. You mentioned Alfred E. Newman, and that was the thing that drew you and I into a conversation because they were talking about Bush that night with Don Newman and Donna Fiducia, and I think Claire Lopez was there, and Trevor.
Claire Lopez was there.
Yep. And somebody said something about Bush, and you said, what, me worry? And I just started laughing because I knew exactly the reference that you were making, and that was the start of a beautiful friendship right there.
Well, it is, and I am proud to call you a good friend, James. But let me tell you, I was working with members of Congress, and I did find the quote, but I want to introduce it by explaining what we're dealing with. We had a real big problem in immigration. Again, we never took the agency seriously, right? In fact, when I was dating my first wife, we went to a comedy club, and it was humiliating. The comedian is up on stage. Picture this. I'm an immigration agent. And the guy says, you want to see confusion? Run in the kitchen and yell immigration. And I'll never forget it. I was infuriated by that. And at the time, I was working on a terrorism investigation. But that was the public concept of immigration. I remember I knocked on a woman's door one day, and I said, I'm looking for this guy. He's a fugitive. She said, immigration? Why aren't you on the border? Aren't you at the airport? And I said, well, New York is a border state. What, are you crazy? And I've made this point repeatedly. We don't have four border states. The lies being told to us, you know, California, New Mexico, Arizona, Texas. No, we have 50 border states. Any state with an international airport, any state that lies along our 95,000 miles of coastline or lies on the northern or southern border. These are all border states. And when people cross the border, they head for the rest of the country. We're seeing it right now in Texas. And no one is talking about other parts of the border. They were all looking at this one little town under that bridge. God knows what's happening along the rest of that 2,000-mile border. And no one knows what's going on the Canadian border. And no one knows how many ships, like the Golden Venture, if you remember, came ashore in the Rockaways back in the 90s. With a bunch of Chinese illegal aliens on board. And nobody knows how many people are getting visas who shouldn't be getting visas or are being admitted who shouldn't be getting admitted. You know, a visa is not a guarantee of entry. If an alien needs a visa, the visa is only basically a ticket that gets that alien into the inspector's booth, but it's up to the inspector to admit that alien. State Department has no authority to admit anybody. That task falls to the inspector at that port of entry. I know I did that job for 4 years. So when I speak about the issues, it's not based on nonsense. When I listen to people on the networks, they know nothing about immigration, but they have an opinion. I mean, how many times do we hear the talking heads? Well, if the immigrant has been living in the country for the last 9 years and has no arrest, it's only reasonable we let them stay. Well, first of all, there is a provision under the law where if you have an immediate family member, a spouse or a child, and you're here illegally, but you've been here for more than, I believe it's 10 years. It used to be 6. I think now it's 10. Forgive me. I don't have the law in front of me. It's been so long since I handled these cases. But it's a significant amount of time with no convictions for serious crimes. Then you could apply to be able to remain here permanently. So there is, in the law, a provision. But if you look at this notion that we're going to take millions of people and give them lawful status because they've been here for X amount of years, the question nobody ever seems to ask, and this comes back to the importance of questions. How do you know how long an illegal alien has been living in the United States if there is no capacity to interview them, let alone do a field investigation? You know, and everyone talks about background check. Background check is not the same thing as a background investigation. A background check means you run fingerprints and a name through databases. Period. That's it. Background investigation means you actually go out and knock on doors and show people photographs. I remember when I was first hired by the government, I had a bunch of neighbors who were, to use the Yiddish term, yentas, busybodies. They were at everyone else's business. And I was living on my own on the block where I moved in. The house I'm in now is the house my parents bought when I was 11 years old. I'm sitting in my office. When I was a young boy, this was actually my room, and a couple of my kids have slept in this room also, so I'm really home. Well, I always resented people mixing into my business. I was raised to stay out of other people's business with the expectation they would stay out of my business. You know, if I think you're committing a crime, that's another story. But if you have a nice car or you're wearing nice clothing, that's none of my business. You're not taking the money out of my bank account. You do with it as you wish. This is America. You're free to live your life. So I remember there was this little old lady who could barely walk, but when she heard, because someone knocked on a door, in those days the FBI did the background investigations, she went nuts. And she comes running up the stairs and says to me, "What trouble are you in? Because they told me that you're under investigation." Yeah, I was being investigated for a security clearance, but I just couldn't resist. I said, "Well, look, under the advice of my attorney, I've been told not to talk about the matter." And she was running from house to house, banging on doors, telling everybody I was about to go to the big house. You know? Oh, I could be evil sometimes, but I just had to do it. You know, instead of saying to me, "What's going on? Why would we?" You know, then I would have said, "Well, I'm getting a security clearance," because they didn't say that. Apparently, they just said, "You know this guy? What do you know about him? Yada yada yada." But that, folks, is what a background investigation looks like, and it takes a long time, and it's expensive. It takes months. You don't do this overnight. They pull up phone records, and they pull up bank records, and they pull up all sorts of records, and then they interview people. But running a name and fingerprints, half the time the fingerprints don't show, and if you have a criminal history in another country, the system may not even be compatible with ours. And we had a case where two guys were arrested by the New York City Police Department, and they ran the fingerprints through the state system, and it came back no record. And I had a bad feeling. I interviewed them, and so I took the fingerprints, and immigration didn't have the facilities. I took the fingerprints to DEA, and they faxed them to the FBI in the middle of the night. These two guys were about to be put on the FBI's 10 most wanted for killing a bunch of people. They pulled like 40 bank robberies. But when New York State ran the prints, it came back no hit. And it was amazing. My partner and I got a very nice letter from the joint NYPD FBI bank robbery task force. And these guys, I believe, were sentenced to life without parole. They walked into banks and just started shooting. They were from Trinidad, not Mexico. See, immigration isn't about Latinos, folks. There's bad guys in every country because every race, religion, and ethnicity has the good, the bad, and the ugly. And when I interviewed them, the guy told me he was an American and he had a heavy West Indian accent, and they said, "Really, where were you born?" He said, "Down south in Chicago." So I figured something was amiss here, you know, down south in Chicago. So, but the point is, I've seen time and again where fingerprints don't come back with the record that it should, and if you use a fake name, it comes back with no records. And now add to that if you're using an alphabet other than the English alphabet. So if the guy's Russian and they're using the Cyrillic alphabet or Chinese or Israeli or an Arab, it's a different alphabet. So there's different ways of spelling the same name that's accurate. And then the bad guys do another cute thing. They flip the month and day. Now, if you're born like November 10th, it doesn't work because it's 10-10. I'm sorry, it's 11th of November, so it's 11-11, let's say. But on the other hand, let's say you were born on January 15. Is it 1-15 or 15-1? In Europe, it could be 15-1. So that on a computer would show up as a different person. So there's so many ways of altering the name so that it doesn't appear to be the same. These are all the issues that we have with running a name check. I remember working on a case involving these two brothers who were Israeli drug dealers involved with murder. They were really violent, and the Israeli National Police helped us tremendously. They actually sent, I think it was 8 or 9 Israeli police officers to the United States to sit on the wiretap, because it wasn't only that the targets of the investigation were speaking Hebrew, but they were speaking slang that only people involved with law enforcement in Israel would have recognized. So they actually provided us with their police officers to sit with us on wiretaps. I've had the opportunity to see all of this stuff up close and in person. So these two brothers, same last name, but were spelled so differently, we never realized they were brothers. And then one day I started to play around with a different way that you could spell that last name. And I kept putting the different variations into the computer. It took me about an hour. And bingo, I identified his brother here in the United States. And that opened up a whole new branch to the investigation. But unless you've been there, you would have no idea that this is how it works. Do you follow what I'm saying, James?
Absolutely.
It was a eureka moment. I was up at DEA Intelligence at the time, and I had to call the babysitter. I was a single parent at the time. My son was, I guess, 3 years old. And in fact, DEA wanted me to go work for them. They loved the work I was doing. I was very gratified by that. The FBI tried to recruit me as well. But I remember sitting there until maybe 11 o'clock at night, sitting on the computer, playing with every possible variation. And in the middle of the night, bango, I find the brother. And then we started to take a hard look at him, and we said, holy smoke, look what this guy is doing. And then we were able to show how they were working as a team, but it brought in like a whole bunch of other players. Now, I had the luxury of time. If you're trying to process 20 million applications or 30 million applications, and everybody that sits on these programs, they'll talk about how down on the border, the immigration advocates want us to do X, Y, and Z. It's not an immigration advocate who wants anarchy in the immigration system. So why are you referring to them as advocates for immigration? It's not pro-immigrant to open the borders to everybody, because when you allow criminal aliens into the country, guess where they live and guess who they victimize? They live in the ethnic immigrant community that they are part of. And who are they victimizing? The immigrants who came legally trying to get away from them. But you don't hear that even on the conservative programs. And the only place that I'm encouraged to talk about it, to their credit, has been Newsmax, period. I'm going to be on Newsmax tomorrow unless there's a change in scheduling, because with TV, you know, there's always a last-minute change. But tomorrow morning at 9:35 New York time, I'm going to be on Newsmax. But they're happy when I do this. The other networks don't want to hear this. And the remarkable thing was after 9/11, I was averaging 30 or more television interviews every month. MSNBC, ABC, CNN, they become part of the Ministry of Truth right out of George Orwell. But when I hear this nonsense, well, we have to have immigration reform. Well, again, if we legalize 25 million people, and I think that's a low number, the number nobody talks about is they will immediately be permitted by law to bring in every one of their minor children and their spouses. And they're looking at the people in Afghanistan. And I had previously said on your program, let's say on average they bring in 4 children. So where does that leave us? Well, it means we have an influx of over 100 million immigrants. And I wrote about it, and some guy commented on one of my articles for Front Page Magazine, and he said, well, they don't have 25, you know, they don't have 100 million kids in Latin America. He's right. They don't, probably. But it's not just Latin America. We have people pouring across the U.S.-Mexican border from every country on the planet, from every continent other than Antarctica. They are coming in from Africa, and we have a big problem now with ISIS and Al-Qaeda in Nigeria, if you don't know that. They're coming in from Europe. They're coming in from the Caribbean. They're coming in from Asia. So, yeah, we could easily have 100 million kids, because it's not just from Latin America. Now, go back and put things into perspective. They've just turned loose, because of what Biden did, over 5,000 5,000 hardened terrorists. Battlefield hardened terrorists have now been turned loose, and now they've been in captivity. If they weren't pissed off before, if they weren't sufficiently pissed, imagine how pissed off they are now. And in fact, one of them is a part of the new Afghan government run by the Taliban. He has like $1 million tag on his head by our government for his activities as a terrorist. And if you listen to Millie and everyone today, yes, the Taliban is working closely with Al-Qaeda. Okay. Now, they don't need to use box cutters anymore because we were kind enough to leave behind $80 billion in military hardware, including night vision goggles. One of the advantages that our military and the Border Patrol had over their adversaries was we own the night. Not anymore. We're now sharing the night. And there's been reports written all about how Hezbollah, which is a Middle East terror group controlled by Iran, is operating in close coordination with human traffickers throughout Latin America. And I'm going to get to that momentarily. But I want to now that I've set the stage for how important immigration is, and by the way, I started telling the Congress that they needed to reconfigure the Immigration Service, the old INS. And I'll just tell you this, because that, I think, is the proper lead-in for what Hosta would wanted, because we were working closely together. We had an incident happen, and I believe it was Puerto Rico, because we used to have district directors, because every office has a district director, a deputy district director, and then you had assistant district directors. You had an assistant district director for what was called travel control. Those are the inspectors at the airport or the seaport or the land border port. Then you had an assistant district director for examinations, and those were the adjudications officer. You had an assistant district director for investigations, and they controlled the special agents, and an assistant district director for deportation, because the deportation officers worked in conjunction with the other agencies to actually remove an alien once they were ordered deported from the United States. And the trial attorneys also worked for the district director. So you had this guy at the top of the bureaucratic pyramid in each office who may not have had any experience whatsoever with law enforcement. Frequently, it was somebody who came out of the adjudications program who wound up running everything, including enforcement. So these were people who had never made an arrest, would be clueless about criminal law. All they knew how to do was adjudicate applications. And I did that job for a year also, doing the marriage interview. So again, I was exposed to everything. I got to see the grand tour. And then I spent 4 years as the first agent assigned to the Unified Intelligence Division of DEA in New York. And then my last 10 years, I was promoted to senior special agent and assigned to the Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force. So I truly had a global perspective on just about everything you could imagine that that involved immigration, including terrorism and drugs and so forth, gangs. I was the guy that started investigating MS-13 in New York back around 1992 when it was a tiny problem. And it literally metastasized across the country when Obama had his unaccompanied minors program. So we took a minor problem and turned it into a catastrophe, because MS-13 is one of the most violent and pernicious of all transnational gangs that we now face in America. Thank you, Mr. Obama. And by the way, even Obama in the last couple of days has said that an open border is not sustainable. And when they asked Jen Psaki about that, she said, well, the president agrees because we don't have an open border. Really? How do you define open? Think about that. So we had a situation, and I believe it was Puerto Rico, but don't hold me to it, where there was a major takedown. And you've seen the dog and pony show where they have everybody from every agency, and they have the guns and drugs on a big table. They bring in the media, and they talk about how all these agencies working together arrested 53 people, seized 20 kilos of heroin, and a bunch of guns, and we've seen this. So they're doing one of these big news conferences, and of course, representing immigration was a district director with zero criminal law background. He just knew how to adjudicate applications. And in the middle of this news conference, the FBI is there, the U.S. attorney is there, the local police are there, DEA is there. This guy starts to talk about a sealed indictment. Disclosure of a sealed indictment is a felony. Think about that. Generally, an indictment is sealed so that the bad guys don't know you're looking for them, so that they don't run, or so that you don't tip your hat about a larger investigation that's taking place. You can talk about an indictment, but you cannot talk about a sealed indictment. That's why they make that distinction. So lo and behold, the TV crew is there, The radio stations are there. The print media is there. And this guy gets up there and starts talking about a sealed indictment. He almost got arrested. And they stop the news conference. And they pull him aside. What the hell's wrong with you? You just committed a felony. He says, oh, the guy was indicted, right? It's a sealed indictment. He goes, well, what does that mean? So in working with members of Congress, I said we need to change the structure of immigration law enforcement. We should not have district directors running enforcement because they know nothing about it. That's like having Mike Cutler go to a hospital and run the neurological, the surgery department. What do I know about it to qualify me? These people are dangerous in that position. We should spin the adjudicators off separately. And then I talked about the immigration enforcement tripod. That should be seamless. The inspectors enforce the laws at ports of entry, the border patrol between ports of entry, and the agents enforce the laws from within the interior, making up probably the most important leg of that tripod. But it's always been the shortest leg because no one really wants the laws enforced from within the interior of the United States. When you hear about catch and release, the reason it's such a problem isn't only because we release people. It's because there's no consequences if they fail to show up. So let me explain this to you. If you get stopped for speeding or for running a red light or a stop sign or whatever, a police officer stops you, that police officer does not have to give you a summons. That police officer can arrest you. You've committed an offense and you could be arrested. So it's up to the police officer to decide if you're likely to appear at a hearing at traffic court. And if that cop says, you know what? This guy has no ID. This guy is of unknown background. We're not even sure this is his car. The cop is probably going to arrest you. And if they give you a ticket and you fail to show up, then they could come to your house. They can arrest you. They can take your car. They can put you in jail. There's consequences. So I don't know what the numbers are of people who fail to show up in traffic courts, but a lot of people do show up because they know that if they fail to show up, their life is about to get a lot more complicated and not in a good way. Without interior enforcement, if you tell some alien show up in immigration court and they fail to show up, guess what? There's no consequences. I don't think I'm going to go to court today. Okay. Is anyone going to look for you? Nope. So why should I show up? I don't know. That's why it's a big problem. That's why interior enforcement is so important. The reason we don't have agents for interior enforcement is like people want to give me a quick answer. Hey, Mr. Cutler, all this nonsense. If you had mandatory e-verify, the problem is solved. What's the deal? Really? No, it's not the solution. We need to have mandatory e-verify, but if you can easily get a green card by lying about being married to somebody, a green card, you sail right through the vetting process of e-verify. In fact, it'll get you right across the border. If Biden tomorrow morning says, you know what, I've got to do something with the border. It's too crazy. It's going to cost us votes come the next election. I'm not only going to finish Trump's wall, I'm going to coat it in Teflon, cover it in grease, and put electrified concertine wire on top of it. And we're going to run 50,000 volts through it. Guess what? You know what could get you past that border? A green card. So if you don't have agents to figure out who's lying on their applications, the wall means nothing and e-verify means nothing. That's why interior enforcement is such an important issue. But, of course, the politicians don't want interior enforcement because immigration agents don't only arrest illegal aliens, they arrest human traffickers, and they're actually like the UPS, right? They're providing the supply. This is a delivery system. The agents also investigate crooked lawyers and crooked employers. I know. I've helped to put lawyers in jail. So how does that sit with crooked politicians? They don't want their buddies arrested. And when they go out to practice law, they don't want to worry that Mike Cutler may be banging on their door, right? So what do? You pass new laws, but you never hire any agents to enforce the law. So it looks like you're doing the job. But meanwhile, you're making damn sure that nothing changes. It's a magic act. So I said this should be a seamless operation where the three agencies work in close coordination, and they agreed with me. And around the time that I had my cancer surgery, I got a phone call from Jim Sensenbrenner's chief of staff. And he said to me, Mr. Cutler, I can't tell you why, because Chairman Sensenbrenner would kill me if I told you. But if you can watch C-SPAN tomorrow at 10 o'clock in the morning, you're going to be a very happy man. I said, okay. And I videotaped it, but I believe we lost the tape when Hurricane Sandy blew through New York a few years ago. And it brought tears to my eyes. Because when they asked me, what would I call the new agency, I said, I would call it the Bureau of Immigration Enforcement. Because it's a simple three-letter acronym. It sends a clear message to the public and to the employees that the mission is to enforce the laws. And thinking about it, when you pronounce B-I-E, you're saying bye, as in what you say to some fool when you put their rear end on an airplane and wave goodbye to them. Now, Lamar Smith at the time was chairman of the House Immigration Subcommittee, and his boss in the hierarchy was the chairman of the Judiciary, which was Sensenbrenner. So I'm watching this, and in walks all these members of Congress, both parties. I so wish I had that video. And they were carrying a big banner that said INS equals ignoring national security. And I said, holy smoke. And then they brought in a new banner. And guess what that banner said? B-I-E. Can you imagine?
Wow.
It was a wow moment. So we got hit on 9/11. By the way, we were hit on 93, and my friends and all these other law enforcement agencies said to me, Mike, we are going to be envious of what immigration is going to get. It is so clear to all of us now that immigration is the reason that the attack at the Trade Center happened. It's so obvious that it was immigration failure that enabled the shooting at the CIA by Kansi, a Pakistani who had applied for asylum and killed two CIA officers, wounded three others, because he had access to a courier van. He bought into that van service, and his van had a permit that allowed him to park at the CIA parking lot. And by the way, the people that rented the van used in the bombing of the Trade Center in 93 that almost brought the towers down sideways, and the terrorists boasted they wanted to kill 250,000. And I spoke to engineers who worked on the bombing, and they said that the death toll might have been higher even, because if the towers had collided, everyone would have been trapped in the building, and there were tens of thousands of people in both buildings. And it would have hit other buildings like cascading dominoes. The seawall would have ruptured, and the Hudson River would have flooded all of lower Manhattan, ruptured gas mains, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The tunnels would have been taken out. They would have flooded with people in them. It would have been a catastrophe of greater proportion than you've seen in most crazy movies that they make. That's how close they came. You would have thought we were going to take it seriously. And in the middle of all this, what did Clinton do? They implemented a program known as Citizenship USA, where they naturalized 1.1 million aliens frequently before fingerprints were even run. I had one of my friends who used to be here in New York. He became the head of investigations at a major office. And he talked about how he was getting zero referrals about suspected fraud, which is a big deal. And he called it the Jiffy Lube process. He had been given the Hammer Award by Al Gore just a couple of years earlier. And I said to him, you know, hey, you better be careful. They don't smack you upside the head with that stupid hammer. And they did. They removed him from management, tried to fire him, and I got Lamar Smith to intervene. So he kept a job, but it was basically a nothing job, so that he kept his paycheck and he was able to collect his pension. He was done for telling Congress the truth. Think about that. And this was before 9/11. So everyone knew that immigration was at the heart of all of these problems. Now, if you watch the documentaries about George W. Bush and Air Force One flying around the country, where do we land? What do we do? Washington's under attack. New York got hit. What are we going to do? So George Bush had a ringside seat. George Bush should have understood, and I'm sure he had to have understood, that immigration was the issue. And he goes ahead and creates what I call the Department of Homeland Surrender. Immigration was supposed to be created the way I had suggested it to the members of Congress. I met with them in person. I was on the phone endlessly. I was running up in those days. We didn't have unlimited long distance. My average monthly phone bill was close to $600. My wife thought I had lost my mind. But I said, we have a son, we have kids. We had two boys and a daughter at that point. Our youngest son, Josh was born. So we had four kids at this point. They said, we're looking at our children's future. And so I was working to try to get everything fixed. And what did he do? He took immigration and cut the adjudicators off, and that's fine. That's what I suggested, Citizenship and Immigration Services. But then he cut Customs and Border Protection away from ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And they were never supposed to be involved with other agencies. It was just supposed to be one solid Bureau of Immigration Enforcement. So they added Customs, and they added Agriculture, and they added TSA, and they added all kinds of other crap, and most of the people put in leadership positions had no knowledge or experience with immigration enforcement. So there was a hearing that was held on May 5th, 2005, by the House Immigration Subcommittee, chaired by John Hostetler. The title of the hearing was The New Dual Missions of the Immigration Enforcement Agencies. So this is 4 years after 9/11, not quite 4 years, 3.5 years after 9/11. So I'm going to read what the chairman had to say. I think it's worth listening to all of his statement, his prepared remarks for that hearing. The first two subcommittee hearings of the year examined in detail how the immigration enforcement agencies have inadequate resources and too few personnel to carry out their mission. The witnesses mentioned the lack of uniforms, badges, detention space, and the inevitable low morale of frontline agents who are overwhelmed by the sheer volume of incoming illegal aliens. If this were not enough, these immigration enforcement agencies also face internal confusion resulting from dual or multiple missions in which immigration is all too often taken a back seat. Sadly, contrary to Congress's expectations, immigration enforcement has not been the primary focus of either of these agencies, and that is the subject of today's hearing. The Homeland Security Act, enacted in November 2002, split the former Immigration and Naturalization Service, or the INS, into separate immigration service and enforcement agencies, both within the Department of Homeland Security. This split had been pursued by Chairman Sensenbrenner based on testimony and evidence that the dual missions of the INS had resulted in poor performance. After the hearing, they said they were specifically referencing what I had told him, but they did it this way, and that was fine with me, because I was still with the INS when I had that conversation with him back then. There was a constant tug of war between providing good service to law-abiding aliens and enforcing the law against lawbreakers. The plain language of the Homeland Security Act, Title D, creates a Bureau of Border Security and specifically transferred all immigration enforcement functions of the INS into it. Bureau of Border Security was what I had called Bureau of Immigration Enforcement. They just gave it a slightly different name. Yet when it came down to actually creating the two new agencies, the administration, meaning the Bush administration, veered off course. Although the service functions of INS were transferred to USCIS, the enforcement side of INS was split in two, what is now Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, to handle interior enforcement, and Customs and Border Protection to guard our borders. ICE was given all of the customs agents, investigators, intelligence analysts from the Treasury Department, as well as the Federal Protective Service to guard federal buildings and the federal air marshals to protect our airplanes, and finally, the INS investigators. CBP was given all Treasury customs inspectors at ports of entry, agriculture inspectors from the Department of Agriculture, and INS inspectors. At no time during the reorganization planning was it anticipated by the committee, meaning the Judiciary Committee, that an immigration enforcement agency would share its role with other enforcement functions, such as the enforcement of our customs laws. This simply results in the creation of dual or multiple missions that the Act sought to avoid in the first place. Failure to adhere to the statutory framework established by the Homeland Security Act has produced immigration enforcement incoherence that undermines the immigration enforcement mission central to DHS and undermines the security of our nation's borders and our citizens. Think about that, folks. It is not certain on what basis it was determined that customs and agriculture enforcement should become part of the Immigration Enforcement Agency except to require federal agents at the border to have more expertise and more functions. It is also unknown on what basis the federal air marshal should become part of this agency, especially since it's been revealed that their policy is to not apprehend out-of-immigration status aliens when they're discovered on flights. If the mission of the Department of Homeland Security is to protect the homeland, it cannot affect its mission by compromising or neglecting immigration enforcement for customs enforcement. Now, here's the critical paragraph. The 9/11 terrorists all came to the United States without weapons or contraband. Added customs enforcement would not have stopped 9/11 from happening. What might have foiled al-Qaeda's plan was additional immigration focus, vetting, and enforcement. And so what is needed is the recognition that, one, immigration is a very important national security issue that cannot take a back seat to customs or agriculture. Two, immigration is a very complex issue, and immigration enforcement agencies need experts in immigration enforcement. Going back, by the way, to what I said, James, about how they put people in charge who have no background. And three, and this is really the kicker, the leadership of our immigration agencies should be shielded from political pressures to act in a way which could compromise the nation's security. While I am grateful for the service and good work of the heads of our immigration agencies, some of whom are leaving presently for other experiences in government, I would urge the administration in the future to place the leadership of immigration agencies in the hands of those experienced in immigration matters. What do you think of that?
Well, it makes too much sense for it to ever work in government.
Well, and so understand why we're in trouble. Both parties want what Biden is doing, but they, you know, so this gives them an opportunity to do what? To scream and pound the podium and get exactly what the people who have bribed them want them to do. Flood America with an supply of cheap exploitable labor, foreign tourists, foreign students, and for the immigration lawyers, an endless supply of clients. Both parties.
Well, and you know, you've told me, and you have been steadfast in this, as long as I've known you, for a year and a half, coming up on a couple of years now, you have told me time and time and time again, the immigration system is not broken, and you said it right there, it is a delivery system, and it's something, you know, thanks to you, that I can see really clearly now, because most folks, they see the chest thumping. They see the breast beating and the wailing, you know, and these guys go down to the border and they look at, and it has to be a humanitarian crisis that defies description. I know it has to be,
yep.
But we'll never see it, but they'll go down there and they'll show enough of it to stir the sympathy of Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships at sea. And that's,
yep.
That's that. And they try to steer this narrative into, you know, we have no choice but to accept these people, to bring them in. And that's not true.
No, that's right. And Jackson Lee, by the way, back then, 5 days earlier or 5 days later, was another hearing, and she went after Bush, as I did, because Bush was given enough money to hire 800 new ICE agents, which I thought was a low number, but he cut the 800 down to 143. Explain why. He was given enough money to hire 2,000 more Border Patrol agents that year and for the next 4 years. He cut that number down to 210. He was given enough money to secure 8,000 detention beds, and he cut that number down to just over 1,700. But Jackson Lee went after him and said, what are you doing? When people come into the country illegally, we have to hold on to them. This is about safety. This is Jackson Lee. That's why I testified for her twice. She was the one with Sensenbrenner who called me to testify about how the two dead terrorists, Mohammed Atta and Marwan al-Shehhi, could have been granted permission to go to flight school 6 months after the attack. So by then, the whole world knew that they were terrorists and they were dead. It was a screw-up of monumental proportions, and it was emblematic of how messed up the whole system was. And everybody was banging their heads against the wall. How could this happen? How could this happen? Well, now what are we doing? 19 hijackers on 9/11 killed more people than we lost to the Japanese fleet at Pearl Harbor on that day, and now how many more thousands have died and how many more are suffering awfully? And we're now admitting maybe a million people with no vetting? And I could point to case after case where people who were translators working with our military in the Middle East turned out to be terrorists. Translators are so critical. I always work with translators, interpreters. Because they become your eyes, ears, and mouth. You're interviewing some guy in a language you can't speak. So you have to depend that the translator is faithfully asking the questions that you're asking and faithfully telling you what the responses are. But at the same time, that interpreter knows the person who is an informant of mine. He gets to see the documents that I'm looking at. It doesn't happen often, but it does happen. When a bad guy gets to be an interpreter, and think of the danger that this poses to America, to our cooperators, to our undercover agents, and to national security. And now you got this guy, Mayorkas, who's going to be determining who we should let in, which means everybody gets a yes. How many bad guys do we need to let in before we have a catastrophe even bigger than 9/11?
They're already here.
That's right. And you have sanctuary cities. Now think about this. You go through hell to get on an airplane. When was the last time you heard of an airplane being used in a terror attack? I'm not aware of a single successful terror plot involving an airplane that was carried out since 9/11. What conveyance do they almost always use now? Motor vehicles. And what are we doing? Giving illegal aliens who can't verify their identities driver's licenses. You could take a New York license because New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Illinois, California, and there are other boneheaded states give illegal aliens driver's licenses. So I could take my New York license, as I have, and go to California, go to Arizona, go to Seattle, and rent a car. Don't tell me, well, I live in Utah, and we don't do that if they don't do that in Utah. It doesn't matter. Because with that New York or New Jersey or whatever, and the terrorists shopped around, the 19 hijackers in the aggregate used more than 360 false names or variations of false names and got driver's licenses and other documentation so that they appeared normal. Nothing to see here. They must be legitimate. It gave them a level of authenticity and credibility they never should have had. And it gave them access to motor vehicles. So what we're really doing is taking the 9/11 Commission report. That's why the Real ID Act was passed, which still hasn't been implemented 20 years later. Think about that one. You know, I was on with Neil Cavuto a number of years ago. The backstory was they called me up, and I had slept almost all day because I was working on a major paper, and I slept. I worked till like 6 in the morning and went to sleep. At 3 o'clock, I get a call, frantic call from Neil's producer, can you come in and do the show? I hadn't even showered. I was in bed because I was sleeping all day. I had just put in like a 20-hour day writing. And I said, can you send the car? And they said, no, you're going to have to drive. So I took a 10-minute shower, jumped in the car. I was still soaking wet. I managed to get a suit on. I raced to the studio. I jumped out of my car. One of Neil's producers sat in my car by a fire hydrant in front of the Fox building. Tragically, that young man died of COVID, by the way. It was awful. And he sat in my car, and I did the show. And they did makeup as I ran through the hallway into the studio. So I didn't even have any time to really think about it. And I was asked a question. It was one of those moments when it was maybe divine inspiration. Neil said to me, he said, Mike, when will you be happy that our immigration laws are finally being enforced the way they're supposed to be? And I said, Neil, I gave it a moment's thought. I said, how about this? When an alien gets a piece of correspondence from DHS and reacts the way you or I would if we got correspondence from the IRS. How's that? And Neil's eyes lit up and he said, wow, that's profound. And when my segment was over and I'm off camera range and they were taking the microphone and the earpiece out of my head and all this other stuff, the texts are all around me. It's like being pickpocketed, you know, give us back the microphone, give us back the transmitter. So I'm giving them back all the hardware, and they're doing a commercial, and Neil looks at me, and he goes, I'm not going to forget this. He said, you're right. An alien in the country should be as concerned as we are when they get stuff from DHS the way we are when we get stuff from IRS. But that's not what's happening. Come here illegally, and we pull out all the stops for you. Come here legally, or if you're an American citizen, you are not even a speed bump in terms of what the politicians are going to do for you. And that's why my question is, why in the world aren't we as Americans saying to every elected representative, how are your proposals in the best interests of Americans and America? Why aren't you concerned with the quality of education American kids receive? Because if this country was truly a country of the people, by the people, and for the people, they would look at America's children, American children, United States citizen children, as the future of America, and say we need to invest in those kids because they are America's future. The only way, apparently, that they want to invest in American children is if they were born here to illegal aliens. Then maybe they're going to get what they want. But if you were born to an American and you're American, get to the back of the line. Who the hell do you think you are? And if that doesn't enrage you, I want to know if you can still fog a mirror. What do you think of that?
We should renounce our citizenship and come over the river.
I actually believe we would make out like bandits, literally and figuratively.
we're in the wrong racket.
We're in the wrong racket. Talk about Rodney Dangerfield saying you can't get any respect, huh?
We would be on easy street like that.
Am I getting anything wrong here, James? Please tell
me,
because sometimes I look at this and I say I must be losing my mind.
No, you're not. The inmates are running the asylum, and we see it clearer every day. We just don't want to see it. But that's the truth.
Here's my contention. If you're a parent, if you have children, if you have grandchildren, if you have a niece, if you have a nephew, if you love America, stand up and tell them, just like a network, I'm mad as hell, I'm not taking this crap anymore.
Exactly.
You've been lying to us long enough. How many more people have to die for social justice when true social justice would mean going into poverty-stricken neighborhoods and providing American kids with free education? And when I listen to these idiots, including on Fox News, Brian Kilmeade infuriates me. They want free college. Let me tell you something. I have a secret. I was on my own when I was 21. When I was 19, a week before I turned 19, we found out my mother was dying of breast cancer. 3 months later, we found out my dad was dying of lung cancer. I'm an only child. We had no family helping us. So every day I woke up, divided my time between talking to my mom's doctors, my father's doctors, going to school, and working part-time on campus. When my father died, I was 19. When my mother died, I was 21. I walked into the house. I was on my own. It was me and my dog against the world. And if I had to pay significant tuition, I would have dropped out of college, and I don't know what would have become of my Cutler. I'd like to believe that my education helped me to contribute to this country. And when I hear about the work Americans won't do, America is a big orchestra, folks, and we all have an instrument to play. And there's a great series on Fox Business, How America Works. And I had people say to me, your father was a construction worker. I said, yes. And let me tell you what. If you give me the choice of having dinner or lunch with a bunch of hardhats who actually do something, or a bunch of thieving bankers, forgive the redundancy. I mean, I didn't know that three-card Monty was a product. What do you think of that?
You know what, Mike? My dad taught at a junior college here where I grew up. And the first 2 years of my college education, it was a blessing because the children of this little junior college got to go for free. But I still worked as a custodian at that school the whole time that I was there. And I hated it, but at the same time, I know that I would never have appreciated at that time, because I was a young man, 18, 19, 20 years old, I would never have appreciated that particular blessing of being able to get that little two-year degree at that junior college. You know what I mean? So, yeah, I agree with you completely.
And our background is very similar. I worked as a projectionist and photographer's assistant on my campus at Brooklyn College. And by the way, one of the people I worked for turned out to be a member of the Tuskegee Airmen, George Bing, who was one of the most amazing human beings I've ever had the privilege of knowing.
Red Tails.
Yeah. And,
that's awesome.
I mean, we got along so well, and he taught me so much. And when he heard that I was into aviation, his eyes lit up. He taught me so much about photography. But I worked my tail off, and that's why I tell people we need critical empathy theory. Everyone goes through hell, or most of us do.
Yeah,
there's no guarantees in this world, and we should be happy when we see other Americans succeeding. You know, I have a small house. It's the house my parents bought. I'm connected to this house because I've been here for decades, and my mom and dad bought it. But there are houses not far from me that are worth millions. And my kids one day said, Dad, wouldn't you love to have that house? I said, well, first of all, it's not the house my parents bought. But no, I said, maybe the guy that bought that house spent, you know, 20 hours a day in his store, 18 hours a day in his store. That's not the life I wanted. I wanted an adventure, and I had an adventure. You don't make much money as a federal agent, but I got what I wanted, and it was an exciting life. I didn't want to look back at this age of, you know, spending decades behind the counter of a clothing store. There's nothing wrong with it. We all have to figure out what floats our boat. I may like vanilla ice cream. You may not like ice cream at all. That's fine. That's America. But goodness, I'm happy when people can be successful because it proves to me the system is working. And what enrages me is that the American dream has become ever more elusive because the crooked politicians, forgive the redundancy in that term, but they have the chutzpah, the brass, to use the term Dream Act to conjure up the American dream for illegal aliens. And by the way, the word alien that we're not supposed to use, it's part of that acronym Dream Act, Development, Relief, and Education for Alien Minors. So when the term alien goes with the narrative, it becomes palatable. But don't you dare use it because you'll be accused of being a hater. How remarkable is that hypocrisy? And that's why in my latest article, I quote Voltaire, who said that those who can convince you of absurdities can convince you to commit atrocities. These are all absurdities, and we need to start to question these people. If you really think everyone needs to be vaccinated, how dare you flood America with a million unvaccinated sick aliens? If you want to build back better, how do we do that? By bringing in more workers than the number of new jobs we're creating. These are simple questions. And how dare you defund police so that we have record numbers of people being shot to death for no reason except they're in the wrong place at the wrong time, including babies and young children. How dare you? How dare you? That's the first part of the question. How dare you? And then let the rest of the question flow. What do you think of that? How dare you?
And there's no shortage of questions, Mike. You know, I mean, you could take, how dare you let a guy imagine himself to be a girl and enable him to the point that he can go into a women's restroom
and compete with a woman in an athletic event?
Yeah, exactly.
Now, I mean, I'll be honest. I'm a New Yorker. I don't care what people do in private. I don't care if you want to jump into a vat of mayonnaise and squirm around on a rubber sheet. I don't know. Pick some wacky thing. As long as they're all adults and they're there of their own, I don't care. I don't care about gay marriage. You want to do that, that's fine. But goodness, if you want us to accept your, what we might perceive as nonconformity, how dare you refer to me as possessing toxic masculinity? How dare you? You know, respect is a two-way street. My father said to me, if you want respect, you have to give respect. So how dare you expect me to accept whatever you want to be considered the new normal, and you reject me for who I am? How dare you? If you're going to play that game, you're going to get the cold shoulder from me. What do you think of that?
That's some awfully damn nativist talk there, Mike.
Yes, it is. I warned you.
You I'm better
like,
be careful.
I'm the sailor. I am who I am, you know.
So you're going to be on Newsmax tomorrow, is that right?
Yes, I am. They usually have me on about once a week. I pop in, and it's supposed to be two segments again. We never know what the realities of their scheduling. But, yeah, at about 9:30, I'm going to be on for about, I don't know, 5 to 10 minutes. I certainly get a lot more time with you, I have to tell you. And I don't even have to try to make myself look pretty. And at my age, that's not even possible anymore.
That's why I had a face made for radio, too. So I know what you mean.
You and me but both, you know, pal.
the thing of it is, and we've talked about this before, and ladies and gentlemen, just so that there's no misunderstanding, any of my listeners anywhere, and I say this notwithstanding the friendship that I have with Mike, and we do have a great friendship. This man is probably America's foremost expert when it comes to the issues concerning immigration and the very grave threat that a porous border and a lack of vigilance at the border, what that means in terms of our national security. And,
my opinion. If you look at the 9/11 Commission report, they were so crystal clear about it. I just wrote about this for one of my articles. I hope after the program, everybody is going to go and check out my article and pass it along, forward it, be part of my Bucket Brigade of Truth. The title of my article is Front Page Magazine, Biden, Con Man in Chief, Voiced Absurdities on Americans. Meanwhile, the threats to American Americans increase. So let me just quickly, before we run out of time.
We got about 5 minutes. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Let me just pull up this one quote because this is really important. And I quoted another article. I frequently do that. I always look at the links because there's always more information because I'm limited how much I can write in my pieces. So I give you more information by providing links to other articles. But on April 17, 2018, the House Committee on Homeland Security, Counterterrorism, and Intelligence Subcommittee conducted a hearing on the topic, the state sponsors of terrorism, an examination of Iran's global terrorism network. Okay? And, whoops, sometimes my computer can drive me crazy. And so the prepared testimony of one of the witnesses, Dr. Emmanuel Ottolenghi of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, included this alarming excerpt. In recent years, Hezbollah's Latin American networks have also increasingly cooperated with violent drug cartels and criminal syndicates, often with the assistance of local corrupt political elites. This toxic crime terror nexus, that is, between Hezbollah and the violent drug cartels, right, and human traffickers. So this toxic crime terror nexus is fueling both the rising threat of global jihadism and the collapse of law and order across Latin America. You would think Middle East. No, Latin America. That is helping to drive drugs and people northward into the United States. It is sustaining Hezbollah's growing financial needs. It is helping Iran and Hezbollah consolidate a local constituency in multiple countries across Latin America, thus facilitating their efforts to build a safe haven for terrorists and a continent-wide terror infrastructure they can use to strike U.S. targets. Think about that. And then page 61 of that 9/11 Commission staff report on terrorist travel has this to consider. And it was titled, Exploring the Link Between Human Smugglers and Terrorists. In July 2001, the CIA warned of a possible link between human smugglers and terrorist groups, including Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Egyptian Islamic Jihad. Indeed, there's evidence to suggest that since 1999, human smugglers have facilitated the travel of terrorists associated with more than a dozen extremist groups. With their global reach and connections to fraudulent document vendors and corrupt government officials, human smugglers clearly have the, quote, credentials necessary to aid terrorist travel. Think about that. So what exactly are we doing now? And they warned about how people falsely claiming asylum, and you have these so-called immigrant rights groups saying, well, you can't turn people away who claim asylum. Now, if the guy lands at the airport and he says, I want asylum, you're supposed to adjudicate it, and that's fine, but we should also be holding them. We used to turn them loose, and they would disappear. Or they would eat their documents on the airplane so they have no documents when they landed. I said, why aren't you making photostats and having it fly in with the flight crew so you can identify who these people are? I mean, you don't need high-tech solutions to simple problems. But if you go into Mexico and you're from El Salvador and you're looking for asylum, you're supposed to apply for asylum in the first country you get to. This isn't the travel agency where you go, gee whiz, I don't know. Do we want America or we'd rather go to Canada? No, no, no. You're no longer in El Salvador, so whatever threat you face in your home country is gone. You're now in Mexico. That's where you should be applying for asylum. And that's what Trump said. It's a practical, reasonable solution. It wasn't viewed as practical or reasonable because it interfered with the immigration delivery system that is screwing Americans into the ground and costing us lives. And this is not an anti-immigrant position. We already admit more than a million lawful immigrants every year. But the immigration laws have nothing to do with race, religion, or ethnicity. Go to Title 8, United States Code, Section 1182. It enumerates who we're supposed to keep out. Simply stated, the immigration laws are supposed to protect national security, public safety, public health, and the jobs and wages of Americans. And I want somebody as a politician to stand up and tell me why they are opposed to laws that are enacted for that purpose. Simple question. Why would you be opposed to laws that protect national security, public safety, public health, and the jobs and wages of Americans? Because that's what they're doing. And that's what Biden is doing.
Ladies and gentlemen, our friend Michael Cutler steamrolling tonight like the 20th Century Limited. We're down to, we have got a minute left. And as always, you know, it's a treat. It is a master's class, at least as far as I'm concerned. Whenever I, well, anytime I talk to you for that matter, when we're talking about what we do, but anytime you're on the program, it is a master's class for my listeners. And I am grateful for your generosity in terms of your time and your friendship as well. And we look forward to having you back real soon. That's tomorrow, Newsmax, 9:30 a.m.
East Coast time. But you got to get involved, folks. I always like to end my own programs, the Michael Cutler Hour, Blog Talk Radio, 7 o'clock East Coast time, New York. I always like to say that democracy is not a spectator sport. Get involved. Have conversations with your neighbors, not arguments, conversations. Get them thinking and end your conversation with a question, because somehow questions make people think.
That's all the time we got, folks. Mike, thanks once again. We'll be talking to you real soon, everybody. God bless you. God bless America. We'll be back here taking a look at things as we do through a conservative's perspective. We'll see you then.